We're taking up the study of the Haggadah in the anticipation of the holiday of Pesach. Bear in mind that while everybody pretty much starts to read, you're supposed to start studying the laws of Pesach, of course. Even if you've learned them before, there's always a tendency to forget and you need to be refreshed. We also tend to begin studying the Haggadah. But the most important time to actually study the Haggadah is at the Seder itself. So, while one should, if you're totally unprepared, it's very difficult to start from scratch that night. On the other hand, if you're too prepared, then you're scripted. That's the problem with the way they teach the children today. I've made that point many, many times, that they pretty much guarantee that the child will not have the appropriate Seder experience. The Seder is supposed to catch the interest of the child, and he's supposed to ask questions like for the first time, and that's the best situation to teach him. However, once you send the kid to school, so already they've been preparing and rehearsing and they got their scripts and they come home and they read their thing, so then they're not participating in the real Seder. You should leave enough room so that there's spontaneity and just ask questions on the spot and have some discussions. Questions being raised with regard to the section in the Haggadah, which is known as Tse Ulamad. Go and learn. The Hisha Amda in the Haggadah is a reference to the covenant between the parts.
Yeah, I found it.
It's sort of an aside. It's not really, in and of itself, does not constitute Sipur. It's not speaking about the situation in Egypt and the exodus from Egypt. It's a reference to the covenant between the parts, and we're pointing to that. That is the factor, so to speak, which stood by our fathers and us. That is, it's a reference to the fact that the redemption in Egypt is not the only redemption in Jewish history. It's a pattern. What took place in Egypt is a recurring pattern. That's the point. Shalalechad bulvad amad aleinu lechaloseinu. For it was not only one who stood up against us to destroy us. So it's introducing a very, very somber note, very serious note, that is that it's not only one who stood up against us to destroy us. And presumably if that's the case, then you could have written it off as an anomaly, an aberration. Eloship hold over door. In every generation, they stand up against us to destroy us. V'akadosh Baruch Hu matzilenu miyadam. And God saves us from their hands. Well, what's the idea? That's what comes immediately before the section of Tse Ulamad. Go and learn. But by way of orientation, what is it saying? What is that statement saying? It's something which is very, very significant. It makes a number of points. One of the points that it makes is that the Jews are a vulnerable people, or, if you will, an endangered kind of a people. Because it's not something that happened once. That could happen. That is to say, it's not a circumstantial phenomenon. Just due to the circumstances, we found ourselves in a position where we were threatened with annihilation. The threat of annihilation is a constant phenomenon in Jewish existence. And there's only one factor to oppose that. Which is what? Which is the bread, the blood of the covenant. That's what it's saying. Because of that covenant, we don't, not to say we don't have to be to fear, but what's the point that's being made? What it's basically saying is that the Jewish people cannot be annihilated. Or, if you like it in the positive, the Jewish people are an eternal people. But they, you could have an eternal, I don't know about an eternal people, but you could have a people that's going to endure. It's conceivable that there'll be a people that will not be destroyed. Let's put it that way. But that could be simply because of the situation that they don't have any natural enemies, like Switzerland or something. There are certain countries So it's possible that a country can be situated in such a way that nobody wants to harm them. That's not the state of the Jews. The Jews are to the contrary. That's the whole point. It's making both points. That is, all things being equal, the Jews really shouldn't exist anymore because they have enemies. What is the idea of every generation? B'chol dor v'dor, in every generation. Because you might, the idea of generation is that things change. There's new fads. The old way goes out. There's new ways. There's new cultures. There's the democracy and so on, the enlightenment. And you'd think then maybe that the world will outgrow the anti-Semitism. Many people believe that. I think that this is probably the most challenging part of the Haggadah. I don't think most modern Jews believe this. They believe that there's such a thing as progress. They believe in the concept of human progress. And that they pin their hopes on the general progress of mankind. Jews have made this mistake throughout history. Those who wanted to assimilate and cast their lot with the societies, the cultured societies, the advanced societies, and so on and so forth. So they believe that anti-Semitism is due to a certain type of a primitivity. But eventually, if people are enlightened, they will outgrow it. B'chol dor v'dor is saying that it's deeper than that. It's very powerful forces. It has nothing to do with the superficial level of the society. In every generation, those Jews who believe that progress, there's such a thing as progress, are always going to be disappointed. Indeed, even today, one of the most amazing things is the extent of the anti-Semitism of today, which is mainly directed against Israel. This is the biggest disappointment that the Israelis can possibly, they can't deal with it. They cannot deal with it. They truly believed that ultimately when the Jews will have their own state and they will become quote-unquote normal and they'll have a country and democracy and that's what, with rights and progress and education, then the entire world will just adore them. There's more anti-Semitism today directed against Israel. That's the irony of it, is that in places like America, there's hardly any anti-Semitism. There has been progress. Whether that's going to be this way always, I don't know, but there is progress. The main cause of the anti-Semitism of the world today is precisely Israel. Israel was established to eliminate anti-Semitism. Also, of course, to give the Jews the opportunity to protect themselves. It's failing on both counts. Certainly in terms of anti-Semitism, as I said, it's the main cause in Europe. Well, that's what the enemies are focused on. You may say that they're anti-Semitic and this is just what they're directing it at. I agree with that, but that's what they're directing it at. So you see that anti-Semitism is just as powerful as ever. That's the idea of b'chol dor v'dor in each and every generation. So it's a basic mistake. There's something over here which is beyond our capability to control. We cannot control it. It's outside of our hand. That's why it's saying, V'akadosh Baruch Hu matzilenu miyadam, and God saves us. Don't think that it's anything that you do. That doesn't mean that we don't have to do. We have to do. It's interesting. We're not absolved from doing things. We saw that in the Megillah, that Mordechai urged Esther. But he said, Revach v'atzel yam v'layhud mimakam acher, that if you don't do it, then salvation will come from a different place. Which means to say that God will never allow the Jews to be extinguished, to be utterly destroyed. That's what it's saying. L'chal oseinu, to utterly destroy us. That doesn't mean that we cannot sustain tremendous harm, that we can't sustain. It's interesting, one year when I was discussing this concept with a group of women, I think it was in Plainview, so when I said, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzilenu, God saves us, so this person asked, well, what about the Holocaust? The answer is that it's not a guarantee that the Jews will not suffer. with the destruction of the temple, the exiles, the inquisitions. The Holocaust is unique in terms of the dimension, the extent. There was no other catastrophe in Jewish history to that dimension, and one which actually threatened to annihilate the Jewish people. I don't know if you want to say the entire Jewish people, had he taken over the world, as he would like to have done. But certainly European Jewry was decimated. So that thought that God rescues us from their hands should not be misinterpreted to give you a certain sense of false security. Because then you could say, okay, so we live in a very dangerous world, but we've got a very powerful ally. That's not the idea. That only means to say that in an abstract way that the Jewish people is here to stay. Netzach Yisrael, the Rambam talks about that. We have a haftacha. But that's the kind of a haftacha which can give you a certain kind of satisfaction, but not the kind of satisfaction that you want. The kind of satisfaction that you want is to know that I can go to Israel, I can live in any community, and I can have peace, I don't have to worry about wars and attacks and things of that sort. That kind of satisfaction is not going to give. Not in Israel, not in America, not anywhere. So the answer is that God saves us from their hands, in the sense of the total annihilation. In that sense. All of that is because of the covenant. That there's an eternal covenant between a God and the Jewish people. But it's one that doesn't absolve us. It leaves plenty of room within that covenant for persecution, because the phenomenon of Om Demolenu L'chaloseinu, that they seek to destroy us, is a very powerful factor. And one has to understand the deep sources of anti-Semitism. It's a very powerful thing. And without the Torah, you wouldn't really understand it. You would write it off as being bigotry and prejudice and so forth, something which is amenable to human progress. And mankind can get over certain prejudices. But it's not the same thing as, for example, when people demean blacks, racism. It's not racism. It's a big mistake for people to lump it all together. I mean, in terms of criticizing, condemning, yeah, of course, but it's not the same phenomenon. It's something completely different. And it's a very irrational thing, very irrational phenomenon, and those who have it are not even aware of it very often. Very often they're not even aware of it. Or they certainly don't understand why they feel that way about the Jew. They would have to examine all of their feelings about God in order to understand why they have these feelings about the Jew. They're not ready to face up to the phenomenon. Well, neither are the Jews. That's one instance of where there's something in the story of Sipra Yetzias Mitzrayim that is not just about then, but hits upon something that's eternal, that's relevant to us. So we make that point. Then you have the section called Seul Amad. Go and learn. Now, this is a different section. And now, as we said, the Sipur, the story is being fulfilled. You're telling the story in, there's different forms though. At the opening, we're studying various halachos of the mitzvos pertaining to the night. That too is a form of Sipur, to explore the many mitzvos that emerge from that night and their significance. Then you have the actual telling of the story. By the way, we've made this point many times, that you're supposed to pause. The Haggadah itself doesn't tell the story. It's different aspects of this. The actual telling of the story is subjective. There's no objective form. The Rambam says that you're supposed to tell the story to your child, and you're supposed to do it on the level of the child. So that's a discussion, that's the story, and the words, you have to make up the words. It's not included in the Haggadah. It's because by definition it can't be included. So if your child is 5 or 6 and asks you questions, you tell them the story. You have to decide what words to use, how to do it. You have another group, older people, so you tell them in accordance with how it makes sense to them. Make it meaningful. The Haggadah is dealing with other aspects of Sipur. So now, you're really supposed to engage in Torah study. To tell over the story through the Torah, the way the Torah records the events. But this is all by way of drush. The question is, where does the drush begin? Now the commentary over here says, Zuhak Damla Drushos. This is an introduction. That Seyul Lamad is an introduction to the Drushos. That's the Midrash. The exegesis on the Pasuk Arami Obedavi. Uchamosh Amr B'Mishnah B'Doresh May Arami Obedavi Achayigmar Alafar Shekula. This is in accordance with the instruction the Gemara says that he's supposed to expound to darshan, so to speak, from Arami Oved Avi. So where's Arami Oved Avi? So the Tehil Amad, there's three lines over there. Go and learn what Lavan sought to do. Lavan the Arami, the Aramean, sought to do to Yaakov, our father. What's the connection between this and Vehisha Amdo, the paragraph? Well, this is an illustration of that point as well, that in every generation. This shows you that the phenomenon that we're talking about, which we call anti-Semitism, is an eternal phenomenon. And it existed even before Egypt, because you have the same situation. That what did Lavan seek to do to Yaakov, our father? And then it compares that to Shaparlo Gazarel Ozcharim. That Paro only decreed against the males, and Lavan sought to uproot everything. So that's the idea. So you're making a statement, and you're supporting it with the verses. Shenemar, as it says, Arami Oved Avi, a string, or it's, there's different ways of translating it. Basically, the basic way is to translate Oved as a verb, that he sought to destroy my father. Meaning, an Aramean sought to destroy my father. This constitutes a drush, because this pasuk that's being quoted, this pasuk comes from Bikurim in Devarim, where the person recites it when he brings his first fruits. He gives a brief recounting of the history of the Jews, and the fact that God redeemed them from Egypt and so forth, and therefore he's obligated. It's a recognition that everything comes to us, the land and its fruits, comes to us from Hashem. And because of that, he's come to place the first fruits before God. But there, when it says Arami Ovid Avi, it's, the sense is different. The Arami in that case is really a Yaakov, meaning he was a straying. Oved is someone who was, it has different meanings, that he was a straying Aramean. What the sense of straying means that he was exiled, and he had to leave his home because Esav would try to kill him. And then he went down to Egypt. That's Yaakov. Yaakov went down to Egypt with the family, thus beginning the first serious exile, the enslavement of the Jews. But here, it's being used in the sense, a different sense. Those very same words can fit a different interpretation, which is that an Aramean sought to kill my father. Because that's the explanation. The explanation is, Mabikesh, go and see. Go and see what Lavan sought to do. And what's the proof? The proof is from that verse, which in its plain meaning is referring to Yaakov, but in its midrashic meaning is referring to Lavan seeking to destroy Yaakov. Vayered Mitzrayma, and he went down to Egypt. Vayagar Sham B'Mseimat, and sojourned there with a few. Vayisham L'Gagado, and became there a great nation. Atzam, powerful. Varav, and many. These words that we just read comes from the text. It's chapter 26, okay. So it discusses the obligation to bring the first fruits and the basket. and place them before the Mizbeach, the altar. Then V'anisa V'amarta. Then you have to declare. Make a declaration before the Lord your God. And then Arami Oved Avi. That's the, you could put quotation, so to speak. So from the words Arami Oved Avi, that's the declaration that you make. It's sort of a, how would you characterize this? It's a very, very condensed version of many, many events. It's hard to imagine anything more condensed than this. Sort of like bullets, almost.
Well, that's why...
Version. It's a very short version, and it's interesting that this is the one that's chosen, because it's kind of requires, you got to fill in the missing blanks. Which is true, there's this drush on virtually any pasuk, but there are certain psukim which stand, you know, it's a complete pasuk, so to speak, it's a complete thought. Here, it calls for drush. The way it's phrased calls for drush. It's clear that this has been condensed. Actually, the translation over here is an Aramean tried to destroy my forefather. That's the pshat, according to him.
Oh,
Rashi, however, there's two ways of understanding the pshat. Rashi, on the Chumash, says, Maskir Chaste HaMakom. He mentions the Chesed, the compassion of God. That's the whole point of the statement. Arami Oved Avi, which goes back to Lavan Bikesh Lakar Sakol. That's what Rashi says. It's a reference to Lavan, who sought to uproot everything. Kesheradav achi Yaakov, when he chased after Yaakov. Ubishvil shechashav lasos, and because he thought to do, chashav lo hamakom ki'ilu asa. So God attributed it, considered it as though he actually had done it. Umos ha'olam, choshev lo hamakadosh baruch hu, machshava ra kamaisa. So Rashi makes a very, very important point. Here too, you see that when a person has to recount the Chastei Hashem, it's contrary to what you think. We can, from time to time, we may have the desire to do so, but it's purely going to be with regard to us, what we experience. That's as far as we can go. But to go back in time to your parents or your grandparents, certainly generations past, which you don't even connect with on an emotional level. But here, to the contrary, it's an objective, it's an abstract concept, the realization that the chesed that God showed in that case, we have to give praise for. It doesn't have much reality for you. It's just something you study, history. Here we see that the perfected individual is able to relate to the chaste Hashem, the compassion of God that was done to people you have no emotional connection to in the distant, distant past, and to give praise for it. Because in reality, it is for you. Why? Because you're intertwined. Had Lavan succeeded, there wouldn't be us. There wouldn't be a Jewish people. However, the Ibn Ezra and others learn differently, that it's a reference to Yaakov. But you can't say then that the idea that doesn't have to be, that the idea that it means the Lavan is a midrash. Yeah, Unculus clearly learns like Rashi, and Unculus is basically just only doing the pshat. That's an interesting concept, that God gives him the status, considers it as though he had actually done it. That is, he's called a destroyer, because he wanted to, even though he didn't do it. The machshava, the thought itself is sufficient. But Rashi doesn't mention it over here. That concept does not apply to a Jew. That if a Jew sought or planned to do something evil, then he's not considered to be guilty unless he actually does it. The plan does not define him. What Rashi is saying is that the plan defines the Gentile. Of course, the question is, why should that be? That sounds like discrimination or whatever you want to call it. We'll put this idea in hold for a few minutes, because our basic idea is to try and understand what kind of drusha this is. So he quotes this first section, Now, it subjects it to analysis. That is, Vayered Mitzrayma. And he went down to Egypt. We notice that the analysis begins with Vayered Mitzrayma. This is the idea of Drush. To take the psukim and to read into them their deeper sense, the deeper meaning. Here it says, Anos al pi adibur. He was coerced, forced, by way of the Dibur, means from Hashem, a nevuah. By Yagar Sham, and dwell there, Malamech lo yared Yaakov avinu lishtakei b'mitzrayim. The word by Yagar, every word of course is chosen very, very carefully. Interesting, the word gar, also the word ger, implies sojourn. It means that he did not... It's kind of like visiting, even though that's not the best word. But it's telling you that Yaakov Avinu did not go down l'hishtakeya b'mitzrayim. To, well, I'll just describe it. To settle, to reside permanently. But the word l'hishtakeya is even a stronger word. L'hishtakeya implies permanence. To plant yourself there in a permanent kind of way, to establish permanence in the land. Did not go down there to establish permanence. Ela lugur sham, but just to visit, so to speak, to spend some time there. Like someone that can go to Israel to for a year. That's not lishtakeya. That's temporary. Or a person can go there lishtakeya. That's it. This is my place, and I want to be planted firmly. That's what it's saying. The word has the connotation of digging in and making it your permanent place. It says, Shenemar, as it says, Vayomer el Paro, Logur bo'aretz banu. They said to Paro, we have come to tarry, or to, not to, to dwell, but to dwell in a temporary way. Have we come? Ki ein mira latzon, ashel avadecha. Because there's no feed. There's no feed. For the pasture, for the sheep of your servants. Ki chaved harav b'yaretz Canaan. Because the famine is very powerful in the land of Canaan. V'ata now, yeshvu navadecha b'yaretz Goshen. May your servants please dwell in the land of Goshen. This is a good sample to analyze and to see if we can resolve Jesse's question. Here's a classical example of Midrash. That is, Vayered Mitzrayim. Well, we have to understand why these ideas are so important, but basically, Vayered Mitzrayimah is teaching us an idea. That is, that he was coerced by the divine command. That is to say, that he himself did not go there of his own accord. That's the Midrash. Then it says, Vayagar Sham, that he did not go down there to be there permanently, but only temporarily. And with regard to the second idea, he brings a proof, Shenemar. With regard, however, to the first idea, he doesn't bring a proof. If you go back to chapter 46 in Bereishis, page 256 in the stone, after Yaakov finally accepts the message from the brothers, at first he didn't want to believe them, finally accepts the fact that Yosef is still alive. So he says, Rav, it's a great, great thing. O Yosef b'ni Chai, my son Yosef is still alive. Elcha b'yarenu b'terem amos. I will go and see him before I die. It means lest I die. It means he's going to go quickly. That is, it's, obviously, he can only go see him before he dies. He can't go see him after he dies. That's not what it means. It means that he has to... You see from this, interestingly enough, that to me implies a certain type of a resistance. That he doesn't want to go. If it wasn't for the fact that he can die, he's an old man. He was 130 years old then. And he didn't know when he would die. So it's the kind of thing that I can't just rely. It's interesting that even with all that separation, and it's his beloved son, he's reluctant. There's a certain reluctance. But I'll go before I die. It means I got to go and see him now. I have no choice. I don't have the luxury of waiting for things to change, the situation to change. Basically, it seems he was reluctant because he didn't want to leave the land. So it was a big, big inyan. that they were supposed to live in the land. And it's only, that's what the Pasuk is saying. The Pasuk is telling us that he didn't abandon Eretz Israel, that he would not have left, except he was on himself. He would have left. El Chaverenu B'Terem Amos is one idea. Apparently, see, Yosef had sent them all of the wagons with the instruction that they should uproot. It seems that there was a bit of a disagreement between them. Yosef was clear that they should uproot and come down and establish a new dwelling in Egypt. Yaakov merely said, I'll go and see him before I die. That's all he was going to say. So that means he'll go visit. That's something else. But then he'll return. And it says that he traveled, him and everything that was his. And they came to Beersheba. Well, it's interesting, but he did leave with everything. So that would indicate that he was planning to move. At least temporarily. Then it says, Vayizbach Zvachim, and he offered sacrifices to the God of his father Yitzchak. What was the purpose of these sacrifices? It would seem that he was in need of guidance. That's what it would seem. That he was seeking some kind of a word of Hashem. Perhaps a prophecy that God should give him direction. Because then the response was that God said to him, to Israel, in a vision of the night, and he said, Yaakov, Yaakov, Vayom Hineni. He always implies that it's something which is difficult, so to speak. Something which the person would have resistance to. That it's an expression of zrizus, of a certain type of a determination to do the will of God, but to overpower any emotion that would prevent you from doing it. Vayomer, Anochi Akel El Gavir. I am the God of your father. Al tira mir da Mitzrayma. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. Ki l'gad gadol asimcha sham. For I will make you into a great nation there. Anochi ered imcha Mitzrayma. I will go down with you to Egypt. Vanochi alcha gamalo. And I will also bring you up from there. The Yosef Yoshis Yodo Aleinecha, and Yosef will place his hand on your eyes. Which is an interesting idea in its own right. What does that have to do with the whole theme? But Rashi takes it to be a reference to the fact that he'll be there when he dies. Rashi, I don't see Rashi over here right now, but if not Rashi, others may mention that point. Then, apparently, he realized that this is what he has to do. Then he goes. Then it says, "Vayakam Beersheva." He got up from Beersheva. He used to live in Israel, and they carried him. Then he has to go ahead. But apparently, he himself was reluctant to leave the land. But Hashem told him that he should go. So that's what's being referred to over here. That we're not talking about the decision to go there in order to visit Yosef. That would have been okay. That's just a visit. And then he'd come back. But the decision to uproot and to resettle in Egypt, that was onus al pi adibur. And what's interesting, though, is that in the Haggadah, no proof is brought for that. The purpose is to adduce proofs from the Torah itself. Then why is there no proof brought for that? Well, then you have the second idea is Vayogar Sham is a different idea. Because it could be honest al pi adibur, it could be at the behest of God, but then it could be to settle there permanently. But now it's telling you that he didn't go down there to settle in, to dig in, so to speak, except to on a temporary basis. Then, why is it that that idea requires a proof? As opposed to the first idea. And the proof is, Vayomru el paro, logur ba'aretz banu. They said to Paro, and now it's being worked out, figure it out from the way they spoke to Paro. Question being raised, the words themselves, how do you derive from those words that they meant that they're just going to be staying briefly, if you want to say staying briefly and then leaving, when it doesn't seem that that would make sense to tell that to Paro. They wanted, you'd imagine they wanted to communicate to Paro that they're going to stay. And of course they're making a request for the Meitav Haaretz, for Goshen, for the best place. And that would make sense if they're going to stay there. But if they're saying we're just going to stay here temporarily, so why do you need that? To the contrary, it wouldn't make sense. It would be a bad idea to do that. I was thinking like this, that on SLPI Dibur, it doesn't cite the Pasuk. Because that's open. The Pasuk is an open thing. It doesn't require any interpretation. So it's just pointing out that it's on SLPI Dibur, but it doesn't have to cite the source. I guess if you go there, it's stated openly that God told him to go. However, the next idea, that he didn't go to establish permanence, that it was just temporary, that's not clear. And indeed, even the Pasuk itself requires interpretation. There is no open statement. That's what Drush is. So therefore, when he's quoting Psukim, he's quoting Psukim, which have to be darshaned. He's not quoting Psukim that state the idea openly. So that's what it means. Look into the way they spoke to Paro, and you will see by way of implication. They didn't come and tell Paro openly that we're just here temporarily and then we're going to leave. But interestingly enough, they did use the word Lagur, just like Avram used it, Ger Vatoshev. So from these words and from the fact that it's only because we don't have the feed, the pasture for the animals, because the famine is very great, all of this has that connotation, that it's not going to be forever. Now, Paro may have thought, they didn't just, did they go further? And they didn't go any further than that. Paro may have thought that who knows when the famine, well, Paro did know when the famine will end. Yeah, but even after a famine, who knows, it takes a long time to reconstitute the economies and so on and so forth, and they'll be here and they'll stay. But they did not make any promise that they're going to... Interesting, they were amazingly forthright. They didn't seek to mislead Paro either in order to get what they wanted. That's another point that one can make. He's not making that point, but that point is there. It's the tremendous honesty that in order to curry favor with Paro, they might have not said that and didn't have to be so honest. No, they didn't say it explicitly, but they didn't fool him either. They left enough room so that if he could have gotten that idea and he could have gotten that impression that maybe it's not, but nevertheless, from their words, you could see that they were not planning to become permanent. If they were, they would have said so. To the contrary, you can infer that they chose words which did not lend themselves to that idea. That's why it's Midrash. It would have helped their position to imply that they wanted to stay and become citizens and so on and so forth. Why would anybody, immigrants and all of that, if you want certain considerations, that is because you want to stay and build up the country and become part of the country. If someone makes it clear that he's only going to be staying here for 5 years or something, so then, all right, you may give him permission, but you're not going to give him anything because he's going to be gone. He'll take the benefits of this country and leave. No one wants to hear that. So it would have been in their interest to give the impression at least, or just to keep it quiet. Don't mention that fact. But they were very open and forthright. I don't know of any of the commentaries that make a point of this, that this shows you that they're people of truth. That they didn't seek to curry favor with Paro at the expense of truth. Gnevas Das. You can't engage in Gnevas. This is a great lesson for Gnevas Das, that you're not allowed to mislead people, even Jews or Gentiles, even when there's a famine and so on and so forth. So they did not engage in that in order to secure their position. And then it says, B'msei ma'at, few in number. K'moshe Nemar, it's interesting. If we really want to analyze it more closely, In the first case of Ayered Mitzrayimah, you have the drush without a support. So I wanted to say, because you don't need the support, it's a fact. Then it has Vayogar Shom, which is an interpretation. And it's supported, but only if you read the psukim correctly. That's a drush. Then it says, Shen Ne'amar, as it says. I'm wondering if there's anything to this. B'mseimah, few in number, Kemo Shen Ne'amar, as it says. Is there anything to be made of the fact that it doesn't simply say Shen Ne'amar, but it's Kemo Shen Ne'amar? Then he goes to the support verse, B'shivim Nefesh Yardu Avasechem Mitzrayimah. This is in Akev. That's in Devarim, chapter 10, Pasuk 22. B'shivim Nefesh Yardu Avasechem Mitzrayimah. That this is Moshe telling the Jews, with 70 souls did your fathers go down to Egypt. V'ata somcha Hashem alokecha. And now the Lord your God has established you. K'chofei Hashemayim l'ro. As the stars of the heaven, in terms of their abundance. This pasuk with 70 souls is brought in to support the idea that they were few in number. However, where's the midrash on that? That's just a fact. You know, this seems to go against what I said before. That is that he didn't cite a source for Vayered Mitzrayma. That is that he was forced, coerced by the Dibur. That's something which could use a source. But I said, well, it stated openly that God told him to go. Well, here too, the fact that there were few in number, that you can glean from just reading it says, with 70 souls. So that's few in number. You don't require any drish for this. Insofar as the purpose of mentioning this. No, he has to qualify from same mud because it's too general. When you say few in number, how few in number? That is, there's different types of nations. There's different types of organizations that can become extremely big and powerful. And nobody can believe that when we started out, we were small. Well, small, there's different kinds of small. You could have a few thousand, whatever the case may be. But that's different. That's quantitatively, but you still had an entity. The point he's trying to make is that you shouldn't think that when they went down and everything developed from there, they still had a group. It was a group. It was a small group. It was a group. It was nothing. You need to know 70. 70 is nothing. That's why he has to bring it to your attention. Even though once you have the pasuk of 70 souls, that doesn't require any interpretation. But he had to associate. He had to associate that pasuk to the idea of b'mseimat. Because without that, it doesn't have the complete idea. You're lacking something. Okay, so it's small, that's nice, but how small was it? That's extremely important over here. Because it was so small that there was nothing. It was not even an entity. 70 souls is not an entity if you're talking about a nation. And the idea that 70 souls could develop into a nation, that is a miraculous phenomenon. That's only because of the covenant. That's only because of Hashem. Given the situation that they were in, given that they were enslaved and persecuted and all of that, the fact that from 70 it became transformed into a mighty nation, that's the point that's being made. That's Chasdei Hashem. It's interesting, there's another source at the beginning of Shemos. That's page 292, chapter 1. It says, verse 5, V'yikol nefesh yotzei yerech Yaakov shivim. And all the souls that went forth from the loins of Yaakov were 70 souls. But Yosef hayav b'Mitzrayim. And Yosef was in Egypt. Interesting pasuk. But why couldn't that have been cited? That is identical to the... contains the same information as the one that actually is B'shivim Nefesh with 70 souls. Did your father go down to Egypt? Yeah, so a good answer is being suggested that the reason it cites the one in Devarim that Moshe told him with 70 souls, did your father go down to Egypt? And now God has established you as numerous as the stars of the heaven. Which means that's the complete thought. It's not only seeking to make the point that there were 70, But that's the entire thought is that from 70, a nation, a mighty and numerous nation emerged. So that's contained. If you just wanted a proof of 70, you could go to Shemos at the beginning. But the statement that the 70 were transformed into a mighty nation, that whole idea is contained in the verse in Devarim. The term soul instead of people, that's not hard to understand. That's how we look at people. The essence of man is the soul. And it's a statement, 70 souls. People will sometimes use that expression, poor soul, refer to a person as being a soul, as opposed to people. It seems wherever there's a matter of some distinctiveness that God relates to them, or in the case of Avraham, with the souls that they had acquired in Charan. So Rashi says it's a reference to the people that they won over to the true ideas. So whenever it's referring to a people on the higher plane, in terms of their distinctiveness, as suitable for the real purpose, it uses the term nefesh. And that's exactly the point. That's why it's only because of nefesh, because of that, that God transformed them from 70. From 70 souls, because that indicates they were special people. And it's because of that that the divine providence related to them, and God transformed them into a nation. We're continuing now with the Haggadah. We were in the part of Arami Ovi-Ravi. And we were tracing these various steps in the process. That's why you can't just tell the story, as we mentioned, you're supposed to tell the story in your own words, but you can't just tell the story in your own words without access to Torah. It's an impossibility because we don't know. Other than the general, we don't know the particularities, the psychological element, the attempt to break them, but to break their spirit. This is revealed to us through the Torah. We differentiated between the Inui and between the Avodah Kasha. That's where we left off. The Inui was more of a humiliation, I would say, an affliction, in that they singled out the Jews for a specific type of excess tax to build the cities. So that was their burdens. The Jews had to bear the burdens. Of course, it's a physical phenomenon, but it's also mainly seems to be a psychological one, because it doesn't talk about back-breaking labors. Then, the Avodah Kasha, which is Farech. And that seems to me much, much harsher. That's a real enslavement. That breaks the person's spirit. Then the person becomes a slave. The misim, the first one is mas, is tax. That's a burden. That's why it mentions sivlosim. That's a burden. But it doesn't make you into a slave. The avodah kasha, the heavy labor, was a real enslavement. And that is much more dangerous. That really destroys a person. The enslavement destroys a person. Let's put it this way. A slave is not a fully functioning human being. It's a form of death, I would say. It's similar to the idea, although, I mean, I'm making the connection. I haven't seen it stated that way. For example, it says that an ani is chashiv kemes, that a poor person, by poor it means really poor. It doesn't mean someone that's low income. It means a real poor person that's dependent upon others and has to go begging is equivalent to a dead person. Now, that's not to be taken literally, and the person, we're not saying he has no value, because we're not measuring a person's value by his money. That's not what it means. It means that this is a serious impediment to his ability to live life. I don't mean just practically speaking, because you could have someone who's an ani, and he could be in a place where people give him tzedakah. The mere fact that he's dependent on others, and that he doesn't have any kind of economic independence, generally speaking, although this too doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to. It depends. It's a psychological phenomenon. If a person can accept the reality, he's completely dependent, and he gets what he needs. He spends the rest of the day learning Torah, and teaching Torah, or whatever. So then, there's nothing that says it can't. But generally speaking, it's not going to happen because man has to operate from a certain state of psychological strength. In order to achieve anything, he has to have psychological strength and confidence in himself, which stems from a certain sense of dignity about himself. And that's a big issue in life. It's probably the biggest impediment to happiness. It's also the biggest impediment to success, which is pretty much simultaneous with happiness. That the person, there are many people that are very skilled at different things, but they can't achieve what they have the ability to do because they're lacking that psychological strength. And thus they're very insecure and they're afraid. Of course the question is, what are they afraid of? Whatever they're afraid of is probably in their own minds, much, much more than in reality. Most of the failure that we're, it's failure, that's what people are afraid of, the fear of failure, due to the fact that a person doesn't have self-confidence, doesn't thinks he deserves it, and things of that sort. And it's all in the mind, because what's let's say you fail, you try and you fail, but it's to you it's a failure, to the person, the other person doesn't really care. We project. We give things a certain reality. We project significance, and we become embarrassed or ashamed. But it's all in your own mind. I'm not saying that there are no occasions where a person can do things that embarrass them. That's a reality, but that should be a fleeting thing, and you move on. But that's the idea. That's the idea of a slave. A slave is not, in that sense, a full-fledged human being. In terms of his own sense of self, you're not going to have a group of slaves that are going to achieve anything other than labor, where they carry out orders. But to be independent and to initiate and to build, which depends upon a certain willingness to make a decision, which is connected to a certain confidence about oneself, so that's the exact opposite of a slave. A slave is someone whose spirit has been beaten from him. That's the second phase here, avodah kasha. The avodah kasha is what renders them into slaves, physically and psychologically. That's why we see that when Moshe came to the Jews, at first they listened, then when there was a setback, as soon as there was a setback, they refused to listen. Because of avodah kasha, it says, the heavy labor, and Kotzer Ruach. Their spirit was very, very limited. Very limited. Now you can begin to appreciate what the purpose of all this is. Because it's praising Hashem. The ultimate goal is to praise Hashem for all the miracles. But in order to do that, you have to be aware of the... That's part of the idea of Maskel Begnus. That is, we begin with degradation. So a person has to appreciate what took place. And the state that the Jews were in order for him to appreciate the miracle that Hashem wrought. That's the end of that phase. That's the description of the severe state in which the Jews were in. I think also when you read this, you get the sense that they were in a situation from which they couldn't extricate themselves. They could not extricate themselves from the situation. Because, quite aside from the idea that the will of God, well, that's something one has to... we read it in the Haggadah, that at the very beginning, that had God not taken our forefathers out of Egypt, then we and our children and children's children would have been slaves to Pharaoh, and therefore it's incumbent upon us to give praise and to tell the story, and even if we're all wise, Kulanu Chachamim, we have to engage in the story. What's the reason behind that? Why is it that had God not taken our forefathers out of Egypt, then we would still be slaves? That question is asked, you know, very, very frequently. Now, in the past, we've stated the reason for that is because it would have been that the question was that a few thousand years later, wouldn't there have been change? And why couldn't the Jews have extricated themselves? So the answer that we've always given is because of divine providence. That whatever happens to the Jews is divine providence. And had God not taken us out, then we still would have been in that condition. We could ask the question, though, is it also true that they could never have discovered the means, the ability, that they were so far gone that they could never have freed themselves of their own if it wasn't for God? That is, the first answer seems to presuppose that, well, the Jews might have been able to get out of it on their own, but God would have kept them in slavery because it would have been the will of God. Or no, maybe that's precisely what we're saying, that the nature of the enslavement was such that it's only possible through God, because we get glimpses of that. They were too far gone to rebel in any kind of a meaningful way, as we do see when Moshe first came to them. All right, at first they heard, but then as soon as there was a setback, they sort of gave up. And they even turned against Moshe. When Paro initially made it harder for them, so they got angry at Moshe. So it seems to me that that's a very valid point. That, and now that we read what the Egyptians, how they manipulated them, and how they brought them down, I think that's something which is kind of permanent. That's destructive. When you destroy the human spirit, that's it. A person can't grow a new spirit. As long as the spirit is there, you can fight back. But once the spirit is destroyed, that's the end of that story. Very difficult, let's put it this way. It's very, very difficult. So what happened? But they did have enough energy for one thing. The next thing is, Vanitzak al Rosham Elokei Avoseinu. That's very, very important. And interesting to note that this portion, which is really the declaration that the person makes, it's in Devarim, that the person who brings first fruits makes, he's talking about the Jewish nation and its history, but he's describing it as us, we. He's identifying himself with that. That's very, very important. Because that's the whole point. He sees himself as part of the nation, and the reason why he's in the land now is only because of the feast part of the nation, and this is the story of the nation. See, it's interesting, if an American was to talk about the Revolutionary War or the Civil War, he wouldn't say we. We fought the battle at Valley Forge and so on and so forth, and then we took this Boston Tea Party, that was before actually. And so you wouldn't talk that way, we. You don't identify with the Revolutionary War. That's the history of the United States, and now you're part of the United States. But I don't think it's the we thing. You don't have that thing. This is a very, very important turning point, because the Ramban makes a big point out of this, as we've seen. That he mentioned this with regard to not afflicting the orphan and the widow, Kigerim Ha'isem, and the stranger, Kigerim Ha'isem, Be'eretz Mitzrayim. For you are strangers, and I will... That is, it's saying that I will hear their screams. If they scream to me, I will hear their screams. So according to the Ramban, this reflects that whole idea that people who are oppressed and afflicted, if they cry out to God, because they have nobody to protect them. So Hashem will protect them. Hashem will avenge their suffering. And this is the first expression. Vanitzak al Hashem l'kei voseinu. This is very important. The Jew... gives you the sense that the Jews had turned away from God, and now they sort of returned due to the situation. When it went well for them, when things were going well, apparently they didn't cry out to God. They lost their contact with God, which is the pattern. That's the way people are. But under the duress, when they lost all hope, it had to get very, very bad, and they lost all hope. They had nobody to protect them, except there was only one thing left, to return to Hashem. So they cried out to God, the God of our fathers. They recognized the God of our fathers. Yishmar Hashem Eskolenu. And God heard our voice. That's very, very important. That without that factor, if they had not turned to God, so then this wouldn't have happened. Vayar Esanyenu. It's interesting. And he saw our affliction. But God sees everything. It's only when they called out to him, it creates the impression as though God wasn't aware of it, and we called out, and he kind of responded and looked. Of course, that's the Torah speaks in the language of man. That's not really true, because God knows. God knows everything. But it's being described that way. To tell you that if you don't pray to God, so he doesn't necessarily take notice of your situation, in the sense of doing something about it. So when it says he saw their affliction, it meant he paid attention to it. V'yes amoleinu, and our labor, v'yes lachatzeinu. Anyeinu we've already dealt with. L'man anoso b'sivlosam, that's the affliction. Amoleinu is the... Amala is like to be ma'amel. You're supposed to be ma'amel in learning. To toil laboriously. So that was the second thing. But then there's lachatzeinu. That's the third thing. The pressure. So in accordance with the approach over here, this is the declaration that's made. Now, in the Agada, we're going to darshan everything. So then it goes back. Now we're going to break it apart. V'nitzak al Hashem al kevo senu. That's the first phrase. K'moshe nemar, as it says, v'hibayam arab mehem. And it wasn't those many days. Vayomas Melech Mitzrayim, and the king of Egypt died. Vayonchu Bnei Yisrael min Havoda, and the Bnei Yisrael groaned from the labor. Vayizaku, and they screamed. Now the Zaka. Vatal Shavasa Melholo Kim min Havoda, and their prayer went up to God from the Avoda. There's different shatim given for the juxtaposition of the death of the king and the groaning. One shot is cited by the Rashbats that they thought they were waiting for him to die, for that new king, the new king who arose and enslaved them. So they were waiting for him to die. Means that they associated it with him. Sometimes you get a bad ruler and he imposes afflictions and whatever, but then he's gone and the situation goes back. Apparently, according to this, they didn't accept this as the permanent reality. They were able to, so it's also interesting, why do I need to know this? Perhaps that's explaining that until that point they didn't cry out to God. See, is that which only reinforces the idea that they should have cried out to God. But as long as a person, there must be a certain reluctance, a certain resistance. As long as the person feels that he can deal with it, it'll go away, so he doesn't cry to God. As long as he feels it'll go away. That's sometimes pretty much denial. But once it didn't go away, the king died, and in fact it got worse, it would seem. So then they were shattered. Then it all became... As long as you can go through tough times. If a person can go through tough times, as long as they have hope, and they don't believe that this is forever, so they can bear it. Even on a small level, you go to a doctor and he's going to say, this is going to hurt. How long will it hurt? So just knowing that it's going to be 5 seconds is different than if you don't know, and it just keeps going. So, because you can deal with it, you can brace yourself. And put up with a lot. Of course, there's a limit to what you can put up with. You're only human. But even so, whatever it is, the worst element is that it's never going to stop. It'll never end. So according to the Rashbats, they were able to deal with the pain because they felt it was just this king. And maybe another king will arise and he'll make it easier. I guess they comforted each other that way. Ukishero she'achar mos ha'melech Lohu kalmei aleihem, and when they saw that after the death of the king, it didn't get any lighter. V'im harishan hekal ha'achron hichbid. And to the contrary, where the first king was a little bit easier, the second king became even tougher, got worse. Oz nenchu harbe. Then they groaned a lot. Below matzu takana el lispalo elokev oseim loshiyam. They had nothing to do. There was nothing they could do except pray to God. So basically, person doesn't pray to God until that's the only option left. But what do you learn from this? What is your reaction to that feeling that they had? The Torah is pointing out that this indeed, according to this Pshat, is how they function. What's your reaction to that? That is to say that they had a certain hope that things would get better, and then it was dashed. I'm not sure that it's a good thing. It all depends where. This can be a symptom of denial and fooling oneself. Indeed, if you study the Holocaust, the years leading up to the Holocaust, where there were many, many signs. Hitler was not exactly secretive about his intentions. He was pretty open about his anti-Semitism, but not just that, about his intention to really hurt the Jews badly. And then there were many decrees. He came to power in 1933, and right from the start, they started making special laws, this. Every time they did so, the Jews would rationalize, that's all right, that's it, this is as far as it's going to go, and after that, he's not going to go any further than that. And subsequently, when he made new laws, they rationalized. And okay, that may be okay, that gave them a certain hope, and you can continue living, but the danger was, since they were not expecting what actually took place, they didn't do enough to get out of there when there was still time to get out of there. You didn't have that desperation. There was always the element of denial. And that's a major element in the story of the Holocaust, not just in Germany and the other countries. That's part of the story. Not to criticize people, but to the extent that the Jews went along and weren't cognizant of what they were headed for. According to this interpretation, that's what it's saying. That they had false hopes. Now, from one aspect, I guess it was good, because once those false hopes were dashed, so they were completely devastated, so they called out to Hashem. From that standpoint, it was good, but that doesn't mean to say that it's rational to act that way. You can't say, well, look, a person acts foolishly, gets himself into a terrible situation, so he really prays to God. So therefore, but that doesn't mean that's correct to live that way. Just because at the end of the day, he had no choice except to return to God. In general, if someone is afflicting you, you're in a situation like that, one should be very cautious. One should not try to lighten it or deny it in any way. This is especially, when it's anti-Semitism, that's a danger. We've seen it now. There's no excuse for this generation to be involved in these kinds of thoughts and denials. Unfortunately, that's what's taking place in Israel today. It's impossible to grasp. After the Holocaust, you'd have thought this is the wisest people. And they still continue to deny and to refrain from really striking back and protecting their people. They have the mightiest army in the area. It's just an amazing thing. It shows you that psychological weakness is the ultimate danger. Weapons, armies, etc. are meaningless. That's the story of the democracies leading up to World War II. They all engaged in denial. Then it says that their cry went up to God from the avoda, from the labor. Yeah, it would seem that the words minu avoda has a significance, because there are two possibilities when a person is in a desperate situation and cries out to God. It could be that the desperate situation was the motivator, but now he's a changed person. But it could be that it's just a cry from the, it's a situational phenomenon. That is to say that he's not a changed person, and if suddenly the threat, the danger, the labor would go away, he'd stop crying. It's a cry which is only from Avoda, limited just to that. Well, nevertheless, it said it went up before God. Then it says, "Vayishmar Hashem es kolenu." And God heard our voices. Can't you? You see, you need psukim for this. How do you know what's going on? You can't make this up on your own when you're telling a historical story. Kamashin Emer, as it says, Vayishma Elokim Esna Kasam. And God heard their groans. So that's translated moaning. Is moaning the same thing as prayer? No, it means that it was prayer, but there's a different kind of a prayer. There's a prayer where, you know, you may be very bitter and so forth, but you summon your energies and you offer a prayer. But here, it was a crying kind of a prayer. It was praying and crying and moaning. That it was very emotional as well. It wasn't just saying the words, but it was
despair.
The despair, the pain was in the tefillah itself. Then it says, Vayishma Elokim Esna Kasam, God heard their moaning. Vayishka Elokim Es Briso, and God remembered the covenant, as Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov, with Avram, Yitzchak and Yaakov. The question is, why do you need both? If God heard their prayers. What do you mean he remembered his covenant? What does that have to do with the situation? The implication is that you needed both. Of course, the question is why you need both, but we'll see if we can explain it. That is two factors. There are two causes here in terms of the response. One is the covenant. If there was no covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, then might not have responded in the way that he did respond. The second one, however, is even if there is a casa, then the question is if there's a covenant, so what's the point of the prayers? It means you have to be on a certain level where you, even in spite of the covenant, doesn't mean that every group of Jews in any situation are going to merit. So it's because you, by turning to God, now you are in line with the covenant, with the objectives and the goals of the covenant. But the covenant was there all the time. It didn't protect them. It only comes into play when they turn to God. If they don't turn to God, then they're not part of the covenant. They disassociate themselves from the covenant. But once they associate themselves, they remember the God of their fathers, Isaac and Jacob, and they pray to that God. So now they put themselves in line. Now they relate to the covenant. So now it's saying that they cried out to Hashem, and God heard our prayers. Then it says, Vayaras Anyenu, he saw our affliction. Let's see what the connection is between all these different elements. But it's very, very interesting. What is the affliction? Now, when we first read the Pasuk, we thought the affliction was the building of the cities. Laman anoso besivlosam. The building of the cities. Here it's giving on the drash, in terms of drash, it's saying something else. Zu precious derech eretz. Well, everybody learns that shehefrishim min shoseim shlo l'shamesh. That they prevented them from having relations with their wives. Now, this, not that there was a special decree, it seems. It does not seem that there was a special decree that they couldn't have children, but rather, in and of itself, since the decree was that all the males should be killed, cast into the Nile, so that automatically put a stop to having relations or having children. For example, the Rid says, Einza Oni Hashibud. This is not a reference to the affliction of the shibud, of the labor. Because it says, V'yes lachatzenu. So, the term lachatzenu, the lachatz, apparently, is talking about the pressure from the work. Here, it's talking about the fact that they could not engage in relations with their wives. Why is it? Kamoshe Nemer, as it says, now he wants to prove that that's what it's referring to. See, here it's a lot of, this is drush. When we read the Pasuk, there's no way we would have known that this is a reference to that. So he's saying it's precious derech eretz. But what's the proof? Kamoshe Nemer, as it says, Vayar Elokim es b'nei Yisrael. God saw b'nei Yisrael. Vayeda Elokim, and God knew. Well, how does that prove anything? Well, first, what does that mean, and God knew? What did God know? All the commentaries are struggling with this. How does this pasuk support the idea that the affliction is precious? the separation from man and wife. So the Avudraham says that God knew. It says that God saw B'nai Yisrael and God knew. It's a reference to something which is hidden, which only God would know. He says, She'ein achirim yodim bo, el HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'vad. This is something which only God knows. Vayeda Elokim. The Ritva also says that he deduces this point from the expression of Vayeda Elokim, which is Davar She'ein yodim el HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the same idea. That it's something which only God would know. But he goes on. He has more to say. Ki meirov ha'inui. He says that he's adding something. He's saying that it doesn't mean that literally they stopped having relations altogether. That's part of it. But even those that did, because of the affliction, they couldn't do it properly, whatever, and they began to diminish in numbers. The numbers began to diminish. If you remember, of course, there was a period of time when they were increasing tremendously. So now they began to decrease. Okay. Then he says there are those who say that he derives it from the expression Vayeda Elokim, that Vayeda is an expression of knowing. The other thing is that term is used in the Torah openly to indicate Vayeda Adam Odes Ishto. He knew his wife. So the knowing means that he knew her sexually. But here it's Vayeda Elokim. I don't know how that works. How could you assign such a meaning when it's referring to Hashem? He says, Ki HaTorah Shei Loshna Kodesh, because the Torah, which is the holy language, Mechana L'Tashmish, refers to Tashmish, to sexual relations, V'Loshon Das, with the expression of Das is not, is knowing. Why does the Torah use that euphemism of knowing? Okay, it doesn't want to say it directly, but knowing, what does that do with knowing? La'orei la'adam, to awaken a person, shelo yasa ha'maisa ahu la'ano ativis bilvad, that a person should not perform that action just for the instinctual gratification, kibahemos, like animals, she'en lahem das, that do not have knowledge. But rather, that he should do this action with wisdom, with mind, to differentiate himself from the animals, who follow the principle of lust. But a man was given knowledge, and thus he should do it in accordance with his intelligence. So that's why it's saying it that way. Assuming that Vayeda, that he did this action with intelligence, with knowing. Lahashlim mitzvahs piri v'rivya ulakim aguf, for the sake of procreation and for maintaining the body. It's a practical need that a person has apart from puruvu. So it's being suggested that we have to incorporate the drush into the text, the plain shot. The plain shot is the humiliation, the affliction. But now it's going into all of the ramifications, and one of the ramifications is that it affected every aspect of their lives. And it made them unable to continue as a nation, to reproduce. This Midrash is telling you that there's a deeper element in the affliction. Now, if you put it all together, it does follow, because the basic idea is that when a person is afflicted, it has an impact upon him psychologically. So it diminishes. So the plain shot is that that was a result of the labors, that they dumped their labors upon them, these special taxes. But now it's giving all the ramifications, which means that there are other things in life that can compensate. So a person may feel a certain humiliation in one area, but then he takes comfort. His wife, his family, he has children. But that they couldn't do that either. So that's part of the inui, part of the degradation. that occurred to the nation. That was the degradation. The Esa Molenu, which basically means our labors, Elu Habanim. This is the children. So this too, Amalenu now is being used to refer to their children. Because the Amel Ha'adam U'masayadav, that the struggle of a person is his children. That's what he's struggling for. So this is a reference to the fact that that God took note of the decree. K'mashin Emor, it says, Kol ha-bein ha-yilod ha-yoret ha-shlichu, that whatever, all the male children should be cast into the river. V'chol ha-bas t'chayon. It says, V'yaslach ha-tzeinu, zeh ha-tchak. That's pressure. But what are we talking about over here? What kind of pressure are we talking about? Yeah, the Shivli HaLeket, for example, says that Yesh Mefarshim, there are those who explain, Al Shem HaDochak, that it's a reference to the pressure, Shehayu Anoksim Dochkim Osam, that the taskmasters pressured them. Lahashlam Tochen Alveinim, to fulfill the quota of bricks. It's interesting, the Ritva says something else. That when the Egyptians saw that they couldn't destroy them, they began to pressure them to convert to their religion and assimilate with them. V'zeu shenemer, and that's the meaning of Agamra Isias Alachatz. That's what Hashem said to Moshe, and also I've seen the pressure. Kizeh hosef ligo lo samehera, because that was a factor in determining that they should be redeemed quickly. Meaning, he's translating what God said. Ki yari anochei, that God is saying that he's afraid, shema lo yuchlu lamod b'nisayon. Maybe they won't be able to withstand the test, the pressure. Ki kfar hischilu l'sar b'hem ksas, because they've already begun to mingle with them. U'levatel bris mila, and to nullify the bris. V'alechaz achrei hakochos alyonim v'kshafim, and to pursue the forms of magic and so on. See, there's two interpretations over here. One is the pressure of the labor to produce the bricks, even though they didn't have this, they had to go and get the straw. The other one was that there was a pressure to convert. Okay, so that concludes that part. So what do we derive from all this? What are we learning from this? What?
The difference between Hashem hearing the prayer and seeing all these things. Why need both?
Okay, that's a good question. I learned that also, it's like in the Yishma Kolinu, it says that Hashem like remembers the peace that he has with the Abba.
Yeah, why do we have to know this? I mean, isn't it enough that God heard our prayers and that's it? What do I mean? He saw this, he saw it, of course. Whenever God hears your prayer, let's say, yeah.
So that what it's saying, that it was cut short because of these factors?
I guess that's what you have to say. That's what it seems. It's telling you, yeah. So now, so what do we have? We have the story. I mean, the development, the fact they went down, the fact that the Egyptians targeted them and brought them down. It's going to the, you know, in a sense, they completely disintegrated. Were it not for Hashem. It's only because of the intervention of Hashem.
What if they would not cry to God and that is, it would be only this third part?
The implication is that they had to pay nothing to save. There's nobody there to save. First you have to pray.
But God might respond still just because he is the Rachum Vahanan.
Okay, so what's wrong with that? Okay. Oh, you mean what?
I'll take that.
No, you mean, but then that's even if you don't call out to him. I'm not saying it's impossible, but that's what we derive from this. The Haggadah is not making that point. The Haggadah is making the point that they cried out to Hashem. Yeah? That's what he's saying.
It seems like there's also an idea like that once God intervened and that was triggered, then like God took care of everything. Although they just cried out because of the pain, you know, God took care of like everything, not just the reason that they cried out.
I'm not kidding. What? I didn't understand that. Did anyone understand? Did you get what she's saying? We didn't get it. Nobody got it here.
I'm saying it was like once God intervened, like God took care of everything that was like not just the reason that they cried out, but everything else that they needed, God provided for them once He intervened. It kind of reminded me like of the point that you made us think about 2 weeks ago, about like once God intervenes, you know, with the, you know, there's complete justice. So even if the person that afflicted the other person, he's also going to be met out with justice. So it's just like a complete...
But that's true. That's true. But that seems to be a different idea. I'm not sure that that's being expressed over here. What?
Yeah, nobody's saying that. Once it started out, it says, we cried out to Hashem, but then Hashem saw, and Yenu Amalenu Machaseinu. So once he was answering, he took care of all the problems.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Oh, you mean because that's not a bad idea. Because they cried out, Min HaAvodah, just because of the Avodah. But God answered with regard to everything. That's pretty sharp. All right, we got a point. That's a good shot.
But may I ask one thing?
You see that obviously God is different than a human king. When you go to a human king and you have a petition, if you're fortunate and you get a hearing, so maybe he'll address himself to that particular. And even then, maybe not completely. As you would like it, partially. But you're not going to find once he takes up your case, and okay, so he looks at your whole situation and makes everything better. That you're not going to find. There's a difference between someone who just responds to a need or a request, as opposed to someone who genuinely turns his attention to helping you. When a person genuinely turns his attention to helping you, so then he does so, he looks over the whole situation. And he'll notice other things you may not even have been aware of. If you call someone to fix something, so 9 out of 10, you're lucky if they fix that particular thing. They may notice other things, but that's only because they want more money. But they're not going to notice anything when it's not in it for them. But someone who cares will look over everything and the wiring and make sure that you have a safe. They want you to be in a safe place. So you only call them because of one thing or two things. You may not have been aware, or you were, but you didn't want to bother them. But that's someone who is motivated to be compassionate to you. It's just that's the trigger. So that's pretty much that's like the idea that's being portrayed over here. that until the Jews, as long as the Jews were steeped in their denial and they were cast away from Hashem, so there was Hester upon them. But once they turned to God, even though it was only Min HaAvoda, it was moaning from the labor, that's basically all they had on their mind, but God addressed everything in the situation. Once God turned to them, it's a complete restoration, so to speak. We're continuing our study of the Haggadah we've been doing here at Masoret. We've been doing Aram Yoviravi, the Drush part. Something, as you read it, the Parsha, Vayaras Anyenu, and God saw our affliction. You can appreciate the necessity for the Drusha. Then it goes on to say, Zu Precious Derech Eretz. This is the fact that they were separated, that the husbands and wives were separated. You can see the necessity. That is, it's very hard for us to relate to what was going on there. We don't have historical records. So, to just say God saw our affliction is not enough. You're not saying anything. It's too vague. The way the Torah records it, it gives the general headings, but they would make sense if it's something that we could have related to. If you're talking about something in this day and age that we can relate to, we can understand what it is, and you use general terms, you have some idea what you're talking about. If you were talking about the Holocaust and using terms, so then they would, each one would call ideas to mind. The type of pain, the anxiety, and so forth. But here, it's very vague. What do you know? How do you get involved in this? It's very, very hard. It's not easy, in my opinion. Chayev Adam Liras Hatzmo, the obligation to view it as though you had left Egypt. That is, that this is something which has a personal significance for you. It's not easy. It's easy to say these things, but you can say whatever you want to say. To actually achieve that level where you burst out in song to Hashem is very, very difficult. It requires, in my opinion, bottom line, to really get into the Seder, a person has to have an overwhelming love of Judaism, of Torah, and an appreciation for the fact that that he's Jewish and that he has the Torah, and this is the story that God removed our ancestors, and we were enslaved in the same way we'd have been enslaved, and he feels this tremendous appreciation. I mean, if you don't really care, if your Judaism is not at the center of your life, if Torah is not at the center of your life, so how is a person supposed to appreciate this and view it and as though he left Egypt and have any kind of a hakaras hatov, a sense of thanksgiving to Hashem? That's why you need the drush, to take the general ideas and give them some concrete significance. V'yasamaleinu, that's the banim. It's a reference to the anguish that the Jews suffered because of the children. That they put yourself in that situation. That they were basically, well, what did you face? Well, that story is brought out. That's the story of the birth of Moshe. Why bother to have children? What would you do in a situation like that if there's a decree to kill the child, the male child? What would you do? Well, why have children? Would you want to have children? It's very, very difficult. Why would you want to have children? Well, because it might be a girl. Yeah, but the pain, if it's a boy, so then you have to subject it. You're basically, I'm not saying you're responsible necessarily. It's not your fault, but it's a tremendously painful thing to have a child only for the sake of being destroyed. See, that's something that we could relate to. They were cast into that plight. Whichever decision is the correct one. Like Amram's decision to separate from his wife, or then, according to Chazal, Miriam convinced him that he should go ahead. To go ahead and continue to have children, knowing the consequences, the anxiety of that situation. With regard to Anyenu, the precious Derech Eretz, that the men were separated from their wives, it seems that there are two versions. Did they do so of their own accord, but under the pressure of the decree? They didn't want to have children because of the decree. Or no, that was a separate decree. Now, in the Pirush over here, it's the Siddur of Rashi, it says Shehefrishim Minshoseim, that they separated them from their wives, Shalol Shamish. Now, that's not brought down openly in the Parsha. It's not brought down openly. That is, it's never mentioned that the Egyptians enacted that kind of a decree. Rather, the decree was that the midwives should kill the male children. But apparently there's a midrash to that effect. It's possible that that was part of it, but the Torah didn't record it because the essential could have been in conjunction with that decree. Although it's very hard to say that, though. It's hard. The reason why it's hard to say that is because he said, "In every girl shall you live." V'chal bas chayin. So that implies they're going to have daughters. The commentator called the Orchos Chaim has an interesting pshat, in that there wasn't a decree, was not a decree, to separate them from their wives, but in point of fact they did indirectly, in that they said to them, if you go home, that they forced them to work. It's connected, of course, to the affliction of the work. So they had to work long hours. And then they would tell them, if you go home to lodge in your houses, you won't be able to get up in time, and you won't be able to fulfill the quota. So that was a pressure. They couldn't go home because of that. So therefore they would lodge, they'd stay overnight in the fields. And their wives would bring them food. Okay. It says over here that the wives would lie with them in the fields, and they would, that's how they would become pregnant. That's the Rashi. All these different ideas, they're elaborations upon a central theme. What's the central theme? The Inu Osam, Arba Meoshana. That they will be afflicted. And so what is it? But then it says, Vagama Sagaya Sheya Vodu, also the nation that will enslave them. I will judge. So it seems that there are two terms being utilized. One is the enslavement, but here it's talking about the affliction. So what's the idea? Was it a decree of enslavement, of slavery, or was it a decree of affliction? So then, why is affliction being highlighted so prominently over here? We mentioned before that in describing this, Vayorehu, they dealt evilly with us. And interesting, it had a plan. That what they did was not just haphazard acting out, but it was done with chachmah. That's why, I don't know if we mentioned as we go through it the second time, Havanas chachmah is very important, because the worst threats to the Jews are the ones that use chachmah, that are able to control their emotions and act with a certain type of a wisdom and a discipline, as opposed to those who just act out their emotions. It seems the other way, that the people who are violent and brutal people are much easier to deal with. But those who control the violence and do it in a planned way, that's what it's showing you over here. As we go through the Midrash, you're seeing that they were very, very calculating. They weren't impulsive about what they did. They did everything with a plan. That's why this is brought in with the Vayoreu, that they dealt evilly with us. They brought a great evil because they worked with Chachmah. That's the first thing that's mentioned. So an enemy who uses Chachmah obviously is the biggest threat. And he can inflict the greatest harm. So it's ironic. I mean, Chachmah is the greatest tool that man has. And a person should live according to Chachmah. But if a person has the wrong objective, the wrong value, so then the fact that he has Chachmah makes him more dangerous. Obviously, that's the story of the Holocaust, that the Germans used Chachmah. They used Chachmah. They planned it. Everything was planned. it was done to deceive the Jews, and all that energy was put into it, that's, they did the greatest harm. But with that in mind, so then Vayanunu. I think that the next statements are elaborations of that point, of Vayareu. Because why doesn't it simply say Vayareu? What is that? And Vayanunu, and Avodah Kasha. These are the elaborations. It's interesting also that it mentions the fact that they built these storage cities for Paro. That's given such prominence. But in actuality, that didn't work. It would seem it didn't work. Because it says, Chashayanu also ken yirbev chen yifrots, vayakutsu. That the more they afflicted them, the more they would increase and spread out. And they became disgusted by Yakutsu. So, but yet this is being highlighted over here. That if anything, would seem to be a defeat for the Egyptians. It certainly doesn't seem like a victory. Then Paro moves on to the next phase about the midwives. Gets very drastic. From a labor tax to build cities, the next one is to kill the male children. And then the backbreaking labor. Seems that the Jews were able to withstand that measure, and yet it's being mentioned over here. But Yanunu, in my opinion, is very important. It doesn't matter that the Jews, it seems, the Jews were able to sustain it, that it didn't break them. Nevertheless, it's being mentioned over here because it's in terms of the inner impact. That it's one thing to be able to continue to multiply, but in terms of the inner impact, that was a major blow, because that was the real goal. The real goal of the enslaved wasn't, see, the enslavement wasn't the essence. The essence was the inui, the affliction, the breakdown, because the essence of the whole thing is really the psychological, the mental, the destruction of the person. Slavery destroys the person, but it only destroys the person because it destroys the mental component, and the person becomes a slave. Once he becomes a slave, he's not a full human being anymore. That's the affliction. In Avadim Hayinu, which is pretty much at the beginning, we were slaves unto Pharaoh, and God took us out with a mighty hand. Then we say, V'ilo Hosea Kadosh Baruch Hu Zavaseinu Mitzrayim, that had God not removed our fathers from Egypt, Hare Anu, Uvanenu, Uvanevanenu, then we, our children and children's children, Mishubadim Hayinu L'Paro Mitzrayim, would have been subordinated, would have been enslaved to Paro in Egypt. And then it goes on, V'afilu Kolon HaChacham. This is very, very important because it's establishing the foundation for our obligation. So we have an obligation to engage in the story and to give praise to God, because it's our story that had God not done this, then we too would have been enslaved. But so we benefit from it. And the classical question that everybody asks is that this took place over 3,500 years ago, and there's no people that were enslaved then that are still in the same situation. Nobody's situation is the same. Everybody's situation has changed. So why are we saying that? Why wouldn't our even if God had not removed us, why wouldn't our situation have changed in the course of history? The classical answer, I heard this from Rabbi Chait, but I think I've seen it in other commentators as well. It's making a significant point, that is that the Jewish people are under the Ashkacha, are under the divine providence. And thus, the fact that they became enslaved in Egypt was due to divine providence. And the situation is such that we're unlike other people. Unlike people operate according to the natural order. So in terms of the natural order, there's history, there's the historical process. But the Jewish people, had it not been the will of God, had it not been the will of God to remove them, then that's the way we would have been, even 3,000 years later. Time is not a factor. So that's one answer. I just thought of a new idea, though. In that, even if you should say that it was possible that the Jews could have gotten out of there, but they couldn't have gotten out of there, because inwardly they would remain slaves. The story that we tell is not just the physical, the geula. The essence of the night is redemption, is geula. So merely to achieve the physical freedom, to break the bonds, to get out of the jail, so to speak, is not the essence. The essence is really the geula. And that comes about through the way God related to them, and essentially when they received the Torah. There were different things that God did to alleviate the mental condition, the slave mentality. So one could say as follows, that had God not redeemed us, then we would still be mishubad laparo. That is, that we'd still be in that mental state. Mentally we'd be enslaved. That, by the way, that is something which afflicts the Jewish people, that quote-unquote a slave mentality, which there is something like that. There is a certain... It's also part because of the experience of the exile. Yeah, but this is the first exile. The fear of being Jewish, the slave mentality, the insecurity, the need for the approval of the world. That's something which afflicts Israel terribly today. And see, Zionism couldn't cure that, but the Zionists mistakenly believed that they would solve that problem. They thought it was a result of the experience of the Jew in exile. They didn't go any deeper than that. It's not true. And then they were very proud. They used to look down on the diaspora Jew. They couldn't identify the ghetto Jew. Because here was a new type of a Jew, the Israeli fighting back, the army, the victories. Yet they have come around to pretty much the same thing. That in terms with the current problem, the way the problem of terrorism and the refusal of Israel to deal with it in a very harsh, violent way because of a fear of what the world will say. And therefore, so essentially you're allowing Jews to be bombed. And it's the same kind of a mentality. What difference does it make to you what people are going to say? Now, they'll say, of course, that it's all practical and so on and so forth. But there's no question in my mind that there is a mental component as well. Because secular Zionism can't cure that problem. Can't cure that problem of the inner weakness of the Jew. Ultimately, the only thing that can cure that problem and transform him is Torah. But as Torah as properly observed. I don't mean just a religious person. I mean, that's simplistic. Just if they were all to become religious, that could help and all of that, but that's not what I mean. It would be to a certain understanding of the truth of Torah and the righteousness of what they're involved in. That's the only ultimate source of confidence that can overcome the problem. Indeed, that's the whole essence of the problem, is that why does the Jew feel inferior? Because he's not convinced of the truthfulness of his position. If he was absolutely... Those Jews who are convinced of the absolute veracity of Torah, they don't suffer. They don't need the approval of the Gentiles. Basically, there are two answers. One can look at it even practically, that the Jews would still literally be in Egypt, or one can look at it that maybe they wouldn't be in Egypt, but they wouldn't be in the state of redemption. It's bringing our attention to a state of redemption. The state of redemption is possible only from God. The whole objective was to destroy the Jews, was really mentally to destroy them, to render them into an afflicted people. This seems to be a one-of-a-kind case in Jewish history. We've had other enemies. It fits into the idea of affliction. Because all of the pride of a people, a major element is every people has the sense of perpetuating itself, the ability to continue. And it's true that, daughters, but it's not the same thing. Any culture, of course the society requires men and women, but in terms of being the leaders of the society, of perpetuating the culture or the religion or whatever it is, it's essentially the men. That was Paro's idea, that if you really diminish the supply of men, it's just going to be the women, so they'll be dominated, they'll be taken over by the Egyptians. You could see that as being the affliction, so that the people would then look at themselves as being coming to an end. It's coming to an end. You're not going to have a future. You're not going to transmit to the next generation. Is it correct to say that that was the foundation? The foundation was the chachma, their plan was to bring these people under their control. See, they didn't. If that's the case, then everything else, the avodah kasha, the hard work, and let's ask another question. It's presenting the various aspects, the various elements of the enslavement. So it mentions the two things. It mentions the inui, the affliction, and the hard labor. But we know that there's more. Then it says that we cried out to God, and God heard our voice, and so forth. And then it says God saw our affliction. But why in the build-up, why did it mention the affliction of the precious Derech Eretz and the Amaleinu, Elo Abanim? Then it brings in three things, and the Tzach. Then it brings in three things, but it brings in those three things afterwards. In terms of the build-up, which leads up to their crying out to God, it only mentions two things. The Inui and the Avodah Kasha. Then when it describes that God responded and saw, then it mentions three things that it hadn't mentioned before. It begins with to summarize it again. We're analyzing that portion of the text, which is Vayoreu, that they dealt evilly with us. That statement is they dealt evilly with us, and they afflicted us, and placed hard labor. That's one statement by itself. The essence of that statement is what they did to us. Well, the evil that they did to us. In the first instance, it's describing what they did. What they did and what their plan was. Now, in this, when it says God saw, so now it's describing the effect. That could be their objective, but whether they succeeded or not, now, when we cried out to God, so obviously we were in a state of pain. And now God saw means it's describing what in actuality was. That they were in a degraded state. But it wasn't just the degraded state from, it's going to tell you all the factors. Clearly the degraded state from the work. But there was an additional element that they were degraded in terms of precious Derech Eretz. Vayanunu again. Vayanunu is describing what they did. They acted in a manner designed to afflict us. Then, of course, the question is, well, were they successful? Were we afflicted? Oh, God saw. That's why it's God saw. Because only God can know the soul of a person. You can hide things from others, but God knows. And God saw our affliction. What was our affliction? The degraded state. And a major part of it was this thing, precious Derech Eretz. It couldn't function as normal human beings. So the one degradation was the fact that they were singled out for this type of labor. That's one. But the other degradation was that they couldn't function as normal human beings in terms of their married life. Then, having mentioned that, the Amoleinu. It makes more sense to say that the precious Derech Eretz, the separation of husband and wife, of course it was engendered by the decree, but that decree didn't last very long. And as the Ramban points out, so then why would that be mentioned as a major thing? Rather, you have to assume that it was the situation of the enslavement. That they were out in the fields working and they couldn't come home to their wives and so on and so forth. It means even the Medrash that says that the women would come out into the fields and be with them. The very idea of those Midrashim, even if you take them literally or whatever the case is, But to have to live that way, that's what it means, that they were deprived of a basic component of life. Sort of like in the concentration camps, even if they weren't extermination camps. But the men were separated, the women, they were just treated like slaves. So, that practically speaking, a person couldn't be with his wife. Lachatzenu, that is the tchak, the tremendous pressure, shows you that they had to maintain the quota of bricks, even when they had to produce their own straw, so they were put in an impossible situation. So that depicts the extreme cruelty, the absolute lack of compassion. Because a person can be, there's different kinds of a slavery, like even in America, there were some benign, some masters that were kinder and didn't mistreat them to that extent, and they have more violent ones. Here, you see the extent of the cruelty that they were subjected to. All this destroys a person. See, God saw over here, takes note of the different scars, so to speak, that they went through. So, Yad Chazaka means the mighty hand, Zu HaDeber. That's a reference to the pestilence. That's one of the later makos. The makos get progressively harder in terms of the painfulness. This was preceded by the Orov, which is the wild beasts trampling through the land. But this is referred to as the strong hand. And he quotes the Pasuk, Hine Yad HaRashem Hoya B'miknecha. The hand of God will manifest itself in your animals, the animals in the field. And then it mentions the particular ones, the horses and the donkeys and the camels and the cattle and the sheep. Dever Kaved Ma'od, a very strong a pestilence. Well, then it says, Uvizrona to you, Zuacherev. That's the sword. Uvizrona to you, Zuacherev. For example, you have a pshat here that's attributed to the Rashbam. Shehargu habchoros avihem bacherev, that the bachoros killed their fathers by the sword. And he quotes the pasuk, "Makay Mitzrayim bivchorehem," who smites Egypt with their bachoros. Arkos Chaim brings this down. Shehargu habchoros avihem, that the sword is a reference to the sword that the firstborn smote their fathers. Kamosha motzina bedrash. Shenichnatu kol habchoros etzel avosam. That all of the firstborn gathered by their fathers. Kishashamu shenitzra paro al makas b'chorim. When word got out that Paro had been warned. Well, this had been going on approximately a year, let's say, from the first makah till the last of the makos. So the nation knew what was going on. It was a big thing. Major things were happening to Egypt. They knew about Moshe. It says that the man Moshe was very big in the eyes of Paro and his servants of Paro. So when he came and he gave his ultimatums, word got out. So now he's saying that the man in the street, the Egyptian man in the street, did not have the attitude of Paro. You see that they had tremendous respect for the Jews, tremendous respect for Moshe, and they would have wanted them to give in. They were the ones that were suffering. So they all gathered with their fathers and said that Moshe just said, Umeis kol b'chor. Moshe just said that every firstborn will die. And everything he said until now has come true. So now they were saying that Fiku halin avde, that let them free their slaves. And if not, then our nation will be killed. Now basically they decided to go to Paro, because Paro was a b'chor. According to Chazal, Paro was a b'chor. And maybe because of his own. He doesn't want to die either. He'll relent. In other words, you see that there was a rebellion, so to speak, among the people that were afraid. they saw that everything came true. And now that if we don't release the Jews, then all the firstborns will be killed. So they went to Pyro and that's what they said. And he said to them, who said this to you? And they said, our fathers said it. He said to them, go out and smite the thighs, the legs of your fathers, who sent you to me. So then it says, immediately the Bechorim went out and they killed their fathers. And that's what it means, L'makim Mitzrayim Bechoreihem. And this Maka was with the sword. Very interesting. That Zeron Atuya, which one would think, is a reference to God. God's outstretched hand, so to speak. This is the sword. As it says, well, the verse, V'charbo shlufa b'yado Atuya Yerushalayim. What's that? You'll have to look this up in Divrei Hayamim. In English, it's called Chronicles. Divrei Hayamim 1, chapter 21, verse 16.